Welcome to the Dairy Farmers of Canada's research podcast series, Paths to On-Farm Excellence, where we discuss priority topics for Canadian dairy farmers. My name's Stephen Roach. I'm an epidemiologist with a passion for dairy cattle health and welfare. I did my master's and PhD trying to understand how farmers, their staff, and their advisors can work together as a team to improve. And I'm part of a team that's working with the Dairy Farmers of Canada to help showcase the latest in dairy research for Canadian dairy farmers, advisors, and their supply chain. You'll find this channel features a number of different series, from animal care to biosecurity to research summaries and beyond. This podcast series features conversations with farmers, veterinarians, nutritionists, hoof trimmers, and other farm advisors, researchers, and many other industry stakeholders. Our goal is really to provide farmers and their advisors with useful information that can be applied back home on the farm. If you like the content here, don't forget to subscribe to our feed and tell your friends. The use of antibiotics on dairy farms is rapidly becoming unsustainable with the continued threat of antimicrobial resistance. It's been the subject of regulatory changes and industry policies, programs, and practices. This is forcing us to explore alternatives to antimicrobials that will still ensure we can treat diseases effectively when they do occur. In dairy, we know mastitis remains one of the major diseases of dairy cattle and is also the cause of much of the antibiotic use on Canadian dairy farms today. Researchers have been exploring ways to help the cow fight back naturally against mastitis pathogens. So, how do we do this? What's involved? And how might farmers be able to harness new technologies to help naturally prevent udder infection in the first place? This is what we're going to explore today. Our next discussion is with Dr. Jennifer Ronholm and her team of researchers. Dr. Jennifer Ronholm is an assistant professor and William Dawson Scholar in the Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences at McGill University. Her research is focused on antagonistic interbacterial interactions, agricultural microbiology, and antimicrobial resistance. So, let's jump in. Well, Jennifer, Bridget, Dongyun, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down with me today. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast and really excited to dig into all of the research that you've been working on the last several years. So I wanted to start a little bit with a bit of a roundtable introduction, give everyone a chance to hear from your specific roles, affiliations, sort of background and experiences, and then we can dig into our conversation. Jennifer, did you want to kick us off?
Sure. My name is Jennifer Ronholm. I'm an assistant professor at McGill University. I did a PhD in medical microbiology, and then after that, I did a postdoc in microbial ecology. So that background kind of gave me the opportunity to look at infection as a more holistic disturbance of a community structure. And that's kind of the approach we're taking to looking at mastitis and other pathogens.
Very cool. Bridget, you want to jump in next?
Sure. My name is Bridget O'Brien. I'm a PhD student at McGill University. I got my bachelor's at McGill also in microbiology and immunology. And for my PhD, it's in agricultural microbiology, trying to understand Klebsiella pneumoniae within the context of bovine mastitis.
Awesome. And Dongyun?
Yes, my name is Dongyun Zhang, and I'm currently in the fourth year of my PhD program in the Department of Food Science and Agriculture Chemistry. I did my bachelor's degree from the Food Science Department from South Korea, Chungnam National University, and then I did my master's degree at the University of Saskatchewan, working on the antimicrobial resistant bacteria from imported vegetables. And currently what I'm doing right now as PhD research project is about microbiota in bovine udder that has been impacted by E. coli clinical mastitis.
Great. So let's start at a high level and sort of work our way down to more specific detail. You've introduced at least a little bit here that broadly we're talking about mastitis and mastitis infection here in terms of the overall topic for our conversation today. Jennifer, can you help the listeners understand a little bit, you know, what more broadly is your research program? What are some of the major key questions that you've been sort of seeking to answer over the last several years? And then we'll work our way towards a little bit more of the specific research project that you've been working on.
Sure. So very broadly focused, my research is about antibiotic resistance and agriculture. So antibiotic resistance is becoming more and more critical and more unsustainable every year. I think today, at least in Canada, most people think that any bacterial infection they acquire is easily treatable with antibiotics. And for the most part, this is true, but it's becoming more and more common that you get infections that are not treatable by antibiotics. And there's very few options left for these people. It's very common when you have a pan-resistant infection that you end up dying. And about 4 million people died of these pan-resistant infections in 2019. And that number is increasing every year. It's projected that by 2050, it'll be 10 million people a year dying of antimicrobial resistant infections. So this is unsustainable from a human health perspective, but it's also unsustainably economically. It's going to cost the global economy about $1 trillion a year to have these untreatable infections. But we use about 80% of the antibiotics we produced in farming. And given the growing resistance and the increases in, you know, human mortality because of them, this use of antibiotics in agriculture is becoming somewhat unacceptable, somewhat unsustainable. The problem is that we don't really know how to farm in the absence of antibiotics. It's very difficult. The amount of production goes down, animal welfare goes down. In Canada, we currently spend about $800 million a year on mastitis. And if we couldn't have access to antibiotics anymore, this number would go up and cow health would go down. So we're trying to find ways of improving productivity and improving animal health in the absence of antibiotics in agriculture. So my lab, from a general perspective, aims to understand the interactions that occur between bacterial pathogens and the normal microbiome of the healthy animal. So microbiome research is still really in its infancy, but there's an enormous potential to harness these powers and use them to treat infectious disease. So what we do is we look at good endogenous bacteria and identify endogenous bacteria that are particularly antagonistic to pathogens and see if we can move these around and spread them to animals so that the microbiome is just a really good protective layer against infection in agricultural animals.
Yeah, that's great. And I mean, it's a topic that we're hearing for some time now more and more and more about in terms of antimicrobial resistance, and one that, of course, you hit on it. You know, the vast majority of us that are working in livestock agriculture appreciate the disproportionate nature in terms of the volume or amount we are using compared to the human health, and then sort of the perspective that the human health industry tends to have in terms of use and where these are coming from, and ultimately how it's going to influence, in particular, access to antimicrobials that have significant human importance as well. So I think that's really, it's a huge issue. It's not going away anytime soon, as you said, and one that, of course, we need to continue to work on. One word you use there that I just want to maybe help call out and define for our listeners is endogenous. What do you mean by that in the context of, how can understanding endogenous bacteria help inform our ability to fight these kinds of types of infections?
Well, all humans and all animals have very large microbial communities living in or on them. So an endogenous bacteria is a bacteria that lives in or on you or an animal. These communities are very diverse from person to person or animal to animal, and very diverse from site to site. And they have this enormous genomic potential to do all kinds of things, like help us break down food or act as a barrier to infection.
Dongyun, Bridget, anything in particular around this topic that really was exciting for you, or, you know, why are you passionate about this topic in particular in terms of researching and exploring it in the context of the dairy industry?
For me, I was always particularly intrigued by antimicrobial resistance. Having a bachelor's in microbiology, we talked about that a lot. I didn't get to learn as much about the agricultural side. And when I realized how often antibiotics are used in agriculture, I was just very surprised and I was very intrigued by that. So I think that's how I got initially interested in that for me.
Yeah, same as Bridget. I also got really interested in antimicrobial resistance since my master's, which is basically using the culture-dependent methods to find out the AMR, antimicrobial resistant bacteria from food sources. But I wanted to look further using genomic sequencing, which our lab is currently doing right now. Currently looking at the composition of the microbiota and the food sources, also livestock animals, and also look at their genomic contents that is also shared with the interactions between the pathogen bacteria and the comings of bacteria.
Yeah, great. It's always interesting to me where people's passions come from and how we all kind of get connected here and explore some of these really complex scientific principles and concepts and so important, as we've kind of outlined, in terms of the downstream impact, not just for dairy, but for livestock agriculture and ultimately human health. Jennifer, you've listed a number of really important reasons why we should care. For the farmers that are listening, I want to kind of really hit home on one key talking point, and I'm hoping you can deliver that talking point. Why should our farmers care about continuing to invest in, be part of, and explore the results of research that are looking at antimicrobial resistance?
It's a great question. Infections on dairy farms cause, $800 million a year just in mastitis. So it's a big economic loss to the dairy farmers. Anytime cows are treated with antibiotics, the milk is dumped. So it's a milk loss on their farms as well. Mastitis is one of the most common reasons for premature culling. So it's a welfare issue as well as an economic issue. Also, if you look at the WHO, World Health Organization, and a lot of their pathogens of concern moving forward, they're the same pathogens that are the ones that are causing issues with mastitis. So there probably is a transfer of pathogens from unhealthy cows to people. And this probably has a direct impact on the farmers' health themselves, even though this is an area that's not looked at all that much. In the few studies that have been conducted, there was a rate at 780-fold higher of methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus in pig farmers than in the average people in their communities. So there probably is links between infections in animals and infections in humans, and in the broader community as well, to deal with a lot of these infections.
Yeah, that's great. And I appreciate too how you link that to more than just health at the end of the day. It's welfare, it's economics, all these things sort of ring true as important motivators to any business. But of course, for our dairy farmers out there, key aspects of what it has come to mean to be a dairy farmer today. Jennifer, last question for you as we sort of start to work our way down to the more specific research projects that the three of you have been most recently involved in. What can you tell us about what you've learned more recently about mastitis as an infection, the microbiome, and the impact of antimicrobial use that's really led you to this latest set of projects?
I think the idea that there is this diverse and rich microbial community in the bovine udder is fairly new. It wasn't that long ago they thought milk emerging from the udder was sterile and that it picked up its community in the environment. But the advent of our next generation sequencing technologies really let us take a deep dive and see that there is actually a pretty big community living in this environment. In terms of the antagonistic interactions in the microbiome, I think there's a lot that's rapidly emerging out of this, because microbiome research as a field is growing extremely rapidly from year to year. So we know that bacteria interact negatively in nature all the time, in soil, in plants, on rocks. But bacteria are actually negatively interacting in and on our bodies all the time. And this recent research has shown that there's clear interactions between, the good bacteria that live in us when we're healthy and the pathogens that are coming in. And there's actually a couple studies really recently showing that if you have certain species in your microbiome, you may actually be, I hate using the word immune because it has nothing to do with your immune system, but immune to the incoming infections via your microbiome. So it's a cool technology, and we've yet to harness it to prevent infections in any species, including humans. But if we're able to do that, that would be an interesting thing.
No kidding. Bridget Dungyun, how would you fit into this equation in terms of some of the practical research that's come out of sort of that exploration, as Jennifer has just sort of described it?
So for our projects, for our PhDs, we wanted to look at the longitudinal changes in the microbiota of dairy cows, which experienced either Staph aureus, E. coli, Klebsiella pneumoniae infection from a natural setting. So by using these, as Jen called it, next generation DNA sequencing techniques, we can then identify which bacterial taxa are within the milk and how is it changing throughout lactation cycles of the cows and how is it making cows susceptible to infection and how can we understand the infection through DNA sequencing.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the methods. How many farms are we talking about here, or how many cows have you looked at? You know, what are some of the details in terms of how you actually collect some of your data to then inform the results that we'll talk about?
First, one of our collaborators, Dr. Simon Dufour from the University of Montreal, collected raw milk samples, which are more than 27,000 samples from 698 Holstein dairy cows from 5 herds in Quebec province once every 2 weeks for more than a year, which were from early 2019 to early 2020. And his research team checked the somatostatin counts of every sample to identify the potential subclinical or the clinical mastitis. Especially for the clinical mastitis, they checked the severity of inflammation of the udder, and they used the culture-based techniques to grow mastitis pathogens and identify the species, which includes the Staph aureus, E. coli, and Klebsiella pneumoniae. And then our lab received the exactly same milk samples from them, and we used culture independent method, which is next generation sequencing, to identify the composition of the microbiota and genomic contents of the bacteria that are associated with the potential interaction between these three pathogens and other bacteria from bovine udder.
So let's dig into what you found. Jennifer, worth starting with you, perhaps. I know your research is ongoing here, but, you know, what's the story you've uncovered thus far? Or what are some of the important pieces that are starting to contribute to the story that you think you'll be able to tell at the end of the research?
You know, it was funny. When I started this project, I kind of viewed it as one PhD project, and it's rapidly grown into three PhD projects. So we're furthest along on investigating the Staph aureus, but it became clear at the beginning that kind of the way the microbiome interacts with each of the different pathogens was going to be different, which is why it got split into three different projects. You know, there's not a good microbiome for every different type of infection. The microbiome that seems to be resistant to Staph seems a little bit different from E. coli and Klebsiella. That being said, we have identified a couple different antagonistic interactions within our data set that does seem to indicate that these commensals might help prevent infection when they're there. And for Staph aureus, it came up as Staphylococcus xylosis and Aerococcus urinaceae. And these two also got flagged again for Klebsiella and E. coli. So it does look like there could be some broadly good anti-infective commensals living in the udder microbiome, but we might have to tweak it and make it into kind of a multi-species idea if we want to reach many pathogens.
And just a term here that some of our listeners might not be familiar with. What do you refer to when you say commensals?
Commensal is just an organism that lives inside a host that doesn't offer a benefit to the host, and it isn't parasitic either. It isn't pathogenic towards the host. They got there eventually.
Awesome. No, that's great. Bridget, what sort of surprised you as you've started to uncover your work? And if you feel that it's helpful to maybe define a little bit how you've been spending some of your time in your PhD, please do.
Sure. Initially what surprised me was the type of cow that was infected by Klebsiella. Klebsiella seemed to infect really sick cows, so cows with a really high somatic cell count throughout their lactation, whereas Staph aureus and E. coli kind of infected cows that were relatively healthy. And in particular, within the herds that we sampled, there were two herds that had a really high rate of Klebsiella infection. And since Klebsiella is an environmental pathogen, I thought to see what type of bedding they were using and the maintenance on it. One herd with a high incidence rate of Klebsiella infection, they used recycled manure, which in the literature is found to contain Klebsiella pneumoniae. And although they changed it regularly, they changed it once every 2 days, there was still a really high rate of infection in their herd. The other herd that had a high rate of Klebsiella infection used sand. And this is thought to be a bedding least likely to harbor Klebsiella, but they didn't change it very regularly. They changed it once every 2 weeks, which is another factor that we thought could contribute to the high Klebsiella rate. The other herds, which had a relatively low rate of Klebsiella infection, they used bedding like sand, wood, and agricultural limestone, which are thought to be beddings least likely to harbor Klebsiella, and they changed it regularly, like once every 2 days again. So for me, what was surprising was the rate of infection that varied between herds and how bedding type as well as bedding maintenance could possibly explain that.
Right. So a pretty significant management piece here, as well as sort of environmental conditions.
Yeah, for sure.
Interesting. Dongyun, I guess same question. What surprised you as you sort of explored certain aspects and facets of this research?
Yeah, so when you looked at the composition change throughout the lactation period from the quarters that are affected by these three pathogens, surprisingly, there is no composition change detected 2 weeks before or even 2 weeks after the mastitis caused by E. coli and Klebsiella pneumoniae, while it was there was a change in advance and after the mastitis caused by Staphylococcus aureus. And what's the common thing, though, is that all these three pathogens caused the dysbiosis, which is basically dominating the entire microbiota, in the quarters from the day that cows experienced the clinical mastitis by individual mastitis pathogens. And while these three pathogens were the most common mastitis pathogens, from our recruited dairy cows, Klebsiella pneumoniae caused the highest severity of bovine mastitis, which was followed by E. coli and Staphylococcus aureus.
Yeah, really interesting. So before we talk about maybe where you're headed and how we can expand on some of this research, I want to maybe take a moment and try and package up some either advice or recommendations or just messages for some of our different listeners here. So if you're talking to some of our Canadian dairy farmers, what's sort of the implication of this work to them? Are there direct recommendations or pieces of information that they can take from your research that maybe inform or influence what they're doing on the farm today?
For me, it's bedding choice matters and bedding maintenance also matters. So from this study, at least, what we found is trying to use a non-manure based bedding and also replenishing it often will help prevent Klebsiella infections.
I would like to highlight the importance of the biosecurity, such as washing and cleaning makers, both machines and the farmers, surroundings of cows and the overall environment in the farms. This can be just a part of the daily routines for dairy farms, but they have to be done properly all the time. Otherwise, the transmission of the bacteria, including these mastitis pathogens, within the farm, but also from outside of the farm, can be done much easier than you think.
And I think for me, it would be that don't be afraid of all bacteria. From the perspective of a cow, some are very good and some are very bad. I think that the post-antibiotic era is probably coming for agriculture. I'm not sure of the timelines, but I think eventually we'll have to farm without antibiotics. And when we do, we might be able to harness the microbes to be our friends in helping to prevent infections on farms.
Yeah, no question. And I guess it brings me to what I'll call, I guess, an emerging, if not, if it hasn't emerged already in terms of a strong recommendation we see our Canadian dairy industry and many others taking in the context of antimicrobial use and resistance, which is selective dry cow therapy. More and more conversation, right, about A, you know, how do we do this? B, who's right to do this either at the individual cow level or the farm as a whole? And then all of the sort of suite of management practices that maybe lead to success or risk factors that maybe help determine whether or not this is right for farms. How does this research maybe fit into that model? You know, I know plenty of farmers that have considered and are unsure about, can I let some of these cases just go unintervened or untreated? Thoughts on that as a practice and maybe how your research fits into this sort of selective versus blanket treatment?
Yeah, I mean, the selective versus blanket treatment is a really good conversation because from my perspective, you know, the less antibiotics we can use on farms, the better. But at the same time, you wouldn't want to see welfare suffer or you wouldn't want to see productivity suffer. So I think our technologies, when we get it working, will be another tool in the tool belt of the farmers. So another way of preventing infection, you know, in addition to biosecurity, in addition to breeding, in addition to bedding, in addition to good management projects to help make that selective dry cow an actual successful strategy.
It's helpful because it really does perhaps those farms that are on the cusp maybe of thinking about, can I make the right decision? Will it work out? That kind of thing. Maybe this is what we need to help them get over the edge and have that advantage, for lack of a better word here, in terms of likelihood for success. Dongyun, Bridget, any other recommendations or pieces of advice that come out of your work for our dairy veterinarians, our practitioners that are having conversations and also thinking about this at a perhaps a different level as they're the ones and more are being asked to prescribe and or recommend the use of different products from our antimicrobials on to talking about and advising for things like management strategies to improve the likelihood that their animals can fight infection?
If I can add on to what Jen said earlier, I think that resistance will develop to whatever you're trying to treat an infection with, but having multiple options would be beneficial. So whether the use of probiotics, like a good bacteria that can fight the bad, or prebiotics, or just allowing farmers to have multiple options to use to prevent or treat mastitis, I think is the ultimate goal for us.
I totally agree with what Bridget says, especially when it comes to probiotics. I think it is more recommendable to use the probiotics that are targeted to the pathogens of interest, such as E. coli, Klebsiella, and Staphylococcus aureus that we briefly talked about today.
Yeah, that's great. And it actually brings me to something I know hasn't been the focus of your research, but I know when we talk about antimicrobial use in the context of the dairy industry specifically, and when we talk with veterinarians or even just actually look at volume of drugs used on a per class basis or across all age classes, we very quickly go from the lactating herd down to calves in terms of opportunity or space for us to perhaps reduce use that's unnecessary use or less effective use. I think about this because the gut health conversation is really what we're getting at here. Do you see application of, and do you have interest in perhaps applying this type of technology and these types of research methods at that level as well? Is that somewhere down the road that might be an opportunity for us to understand better? Or do we really need to uncover and focus much more at the adult stage at this point in the research?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of gut health pathogens in cows that might be good targets for other gastrointestinal probiotics. I think one of the ones that I'm very interested in now is Salmonella Dublin. I mean, you see decreases in herd productivity once they become colonized, and Salmonella Dublin is already resistant to so many antibiotics. Most strains that are circulating are resistant to most antibiotics. So I think that could be an interesting opportunity to have particularly good antagonists of Salmonella Dublin in your dairy herd, so that you don't become colonized in the first place. I think there could be options for interventions on that front as well.
Yeah, really interesting just to see how this type of work can be applied as we start to understand more and our ability becomes much more effective at tackling some of these challenges. Salmonella Dublin, no question, is a big challenge for many provinces in particular, Ontario, Quebec, but seems to be becoming more and more of an emerging issue as we go west in Canada as well. Where do we go from here more immediately, Jennifer? What's sort of the next immediate steps in the context of your existing research?
So the techniques that we used in Bridget and Dongyun's project were primarily genomic techniques. We looked at the DNA that was present in the milk left over from the bacteria. We don't have very many live bacteria taken from healthy milk yet. So we know the names of the bacteria that appear to be antagonistic towards the mastitis pathogens, but we don't have that isolate on a plate yet. So we have new graduate students just coming in and starting PhDs and master students whose job it is to go and look at these super healthy cows and start taking milk samples from them and try and come up with some of these isolates that might be antagonists towards our pathogens of interest. I think after that, the next big problem is delivery and formulation. So how do we get a good microbiome in every udder and displace the microbiomes there so that you can get that disease resistance over time?
Have other scientists looked at this and provide some insight to that question? Or are we really just sort of opening Pandora's box to try and figure out what might work?
There's been many attempts at microbiome manipulation in lots of different systems over the years. You know, taking your morning probiotic, taking your yogurt every day is one of those. You also see attempts, you know, fecal transplant in humans to deal with C. difficile infections is another, you know, microbiome manipulation treatment. You also see people using antibiotics to kind of deplete what's perceived as a bad microbiome so it can be reestablished with a good one. So there's been many attempts in many systems, but there's no clear-cut microbiome therapeutics existing to prevent infection at this moment in time.
Right. So you've got your work cut out for you as we move forward.
I would say so.
Great. Well, it is really helpful to get some insight into what you found thus far, where you're headed, and ultimately where this broader research program, yours and many other scientists, are interested in going, and certainly seems to be an interesting and promising opportunity given the sort of medium term, if that's maybe fair, outlook in terms of our industry and the policies that govern or at least put some parameters in place on how we operate and ultimately how we can treat the health of our cows. I want to just maybe ask one more question. Jennifer, when we were recently doing a webinar talking about some of the research that your team's been producing, we talked a little bit about sort of more broader application. And one of the questions that came up, you've already commented on, which was sort of, are we heading towards some sort of era where we're not going to be able to have either A, decisions around which products we use to treat, or are we going to be at the point where we actually can't use many of the treatments we're accustomed to and have been able to use today to treat infection in our animals long term? And it sounds like that, you know, you feel like that's certainly imminent or is going to come if it hasn't already come at some level. And we don't have to look far across the ocean to see the Netherlands and places like that where we see much tighter restriction and expectation on that. A question that a producer had asked, and I think it might be, you know, worth sharing here, is had said, you know, could your work help to inform policy around antimicrobial use and stewardship? Because there is no shortage of conversations from the federal government on down about what should regulations and policies do, and looking at places like the US and the UK and the Netherlands and so on. I thought you had a really interesting response to that question. What are your thoughts? How does this research and policy sort of interact here?
Yeah. So I think public policy is actually a really great tool when wield it in an appropriate manner to control infectious disease and to manage infectious disease. I don't see microbiome research informing public policy when it comes to agricultural settings. I think that my approach and my techniques and this technology is a really good response to public policy that could be coming in the future. I have no inside line on the public policies that are going to be coming to govern antibiotics and agriculture. I have no idea what the future is going to bring. But I'm thinking about a world where 10 million people die a year of antimicrobial infections. And I try to envision what that would look like. And with $1 trillion in economics lost a year to those infections, I just can't imagine that agriculture will be the priority in that world. So if there's a limited amount of use left, there's probably going to be some very problematic bans when it comes to agricultural productivity. And I think getting ready for that now by producing things that are agricultural centric and specifically made for food productivity, as opposed to trying to take human probiotics and modify them for cows, is a step in the right direction towards figuring out how we're going to feed ourselves in that world.
I think that's very well said. Bridget Dongyun, any final pieces of advice or just take-home messages that you'd like to share with our listeners in terms of the implications of the work that you've been doing, or again, where you specifically are interested in heading in the context of this type of research?
That's a hard question. Maybe be open-minded to possibilities to prevent infection. Like, that's a good piece of advice.
Yeah. Even though there's so many research works going on to tackle the issues coming from bovine mastitis, why we are not too sure about the I would say holy grail treatment for bovine mastitis, which I already mentioned, but to focus on the biosecurity from farms and the farmers and the cows are still a really important thing when it comes to preventing the bovine mastitis and other infections.
Yeah, at the end of the day, as an epidemiologist, I appreciate that. You know, prevention at the end of the day is always going to be our best path, right? And then recognizing that in today's environment, a commercial environment, dairy situations, that can be challenging to completely prevent infection. And so then exploring and building out that toolbox so that we have options ultimately when it comes to dealing with infection are so critical, and which is why I think this research is so cool. And so important as well. So I think that's a great place to leave it for now. Jennifer, Bridget, Dongyun, thank you so much for taking the time to share with us, for the work that you're doing and for your engagement in the industry. I think this is really going to be promising work, and excited to see where this goes. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Dairy Farmers of Canada's research podcast series. I hope you enjoyed our discussion. For more information, please visit dairyfarmersofcanada.ca/en/dairy-research. This podcast was narrated by myself, Stephen Roach, edited and produced by Carly Wright. Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The project is part of Dairy Research Cluster 3, a national research funding program made possible by Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada's Agri-Science Clusters program, the Dairy Farmers of Canada, Lactinet, and Novalay.